3230610 in re marriage of Henry, I'm sorry, Heather Burns Appley and August Liffrith appellant.
Mr. Douglas, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. Putting it very succinctly, our position is that the trial court abused its discretion in not granting a retroactive award of child support. With respect to how that can be, no one disagrees that per Section 510 of the Illinois Marriage and Dissolution of Marriage Act, a retroactive award may lie. We do agree that this court should review the trial court's decision by determining whether the trial court abused its discretion. Now, in determining what the trial court should have done per Section 510, I believe this court should look at Section 505, because after all, that retroactive award of support is an award of support, child support being governed by 505. The underlying petition was brought pursuant to Section 505. So the court should look at those factors. Principal among them, the financial resources and needs of the parents. I thought I heard something, that's why I paused. So with respect to that, certainly I believe that it would be appropriate in this court determining whether the trial court erred or abused its discretion to look at Section 510. It's axiomatic that when you're reviewing a statute, you look at its plain meaning, you don't look at it in isolation. I believe it would constitute an absurd result for the court to find that in awarding child support, you would consider the dictates of Section 505, but would not consider them in connection with a retroactive award. Because in looking at Section 510 standing alone, it doesn't really say, here's the standards to look at in determining what to do with a retroactive award.
What's our jurisdiction, Mr. Douglas?
Well, with respect to jurisdiction, I do believe we do have a final order below. With respect to that issue, the nature of what the trial court did, I believe makes it a final order.
So where do we find the 304A finding?
I'm not saying there's a 304A finding. I'm suggesting that the order is in of itself final. I'm sure we're talking about the idea of...
What does 304A require?
Well, 304A, the court counsel could have asked for basically that order to be appealable even if other matters were pending. It could have been asked at that time when the judge said we are going to enter an arrearage order based upon what the SDU
there
says.
Other matters pending is what you're telling me?
Well, you can ask for that if there are, right?
So, your view is there weren't?
My view is that the order that was entered adjudicating the motion for child support was a final order, period. It is my position that there need not be any language that this is a findable and appealable without any need and enforceable per 304A because of exactly what the trial court did. Now, if the trial court had said, you get support August, we are going to figure out what this arrearage is and adjudicate it, that would be different. But I'm pointing to page 2285, volume 3, and the record, the court finds the record does not allow the court to calculate the current amount of that arrearage. So let me pause there. So that finding by the trial court is a direct expression that we are not going to adjudicate this further because the record doesn't allow me to do it. The court found that the party should submit appropriate paperwork to effectuate these directions. So by that language, by that finding, the court is simply directing the execution of the judgment. Not exactly, but similar to saying, list the property, do this, do that.
Yeah, what's this execution of this paperwork you're talking about?
A withholding notice.
Huh? So, what's that?
A withholding notice. And I believe that was referred to by opposing counsel in arguing that the a judgment is not final, but a withholding notice isn't. A withholding notice simply enforces the underlying judgment. It isn't a modification of it. And again, the trial court.
Does that withholding notice ever come before the court?
My recollection is I tried to supplement the record to see what has happened, but my understanding from trial counsel is that the trial court did not enter the order dealing with, or the withholding notice, I should say, dealing with plugging in what August owes per the SDU, because the trial court thinks it can't because of the pending appeal. And to that, I would say, the trial court still retains some jurisdiction. I mean, generally speaking, as you know, when a notice of appeal is filed, the court retains jurisdiction to enforce but not modify orders. So that the trial court is doing what it's doing, and I can't say yes, that withholding notice entered is what it is, but I don't think that is a concession or expression that the underlying order is not final. What would, to be honest, to make it not final is if the trial court found, yes, the record does allow me to calculate the arrearage. Yes, we're going to litigate that. Put on your evidence, you put on your evidence. In that case, then there would be a big problem with finality. But for the trial judge to say, whatever the SDU says, that's the number, the record doesn't permit me to litigate this, plug it in and enter withholding notice and leave. And I'm speaking very plainly and expressing what it's happening.
But we appreciate it. Plain language is very appreciated.
Yeah, if I may, I mean, is it appropriate for the trial court to punt to the SDU and these folks are stuck with it? I mean, don't they get to look at the number and decide whether or not they wish to dispute it?
So, okay. That's actually a very, I thought about that. That is actually a very good question. To me, in theory, that is something that August could have appealed, and that I did not argue that. So I didn't.
How do you appeal something you don't know if you like yet?
Well, yeah, I know. Well, there's that issue too. but there was no cross appeal either. So as to that, I didn't raise
that. Doesn't matter. You brought the appeal.
No, right. But I didn't raise an argument that was wrong. So to me, both of us, August and Heather, could have complained of that being error, but neither did. So I don't think that is before this court.
But that doesn't go to we have to examine our own jurisdiction.
No. Of some of the matters, like any case, some of the matters raised by my opponents, some I strongly disagree. I do agree this warrants a discussion. Obviously, you always have to look at to whether or not you have jurisdiction. So I don't agree. I do agree it's a legitimate subject. Opposing counsel raised it, and I knew it would come up. But to me, the particular nature of what the trial court did is what renders it final. Bertani's question.
Bertani.
Okay.
And no offense taken.
I have a simple last name to pronounce. Was that a good idea?
Not a good idea. Not a good idea.
Practice. I've been practicing 30 something years. I mean, I'm not going to claim that was the best way to handle that. I haven't even thought to what the precise objection to that would be to process. I don't know, but in effect, that the court did it that way. I said, and I know there's a difference. There is little difference between saying whatever the SDU says, that's the number, and expressing a number, right, wrong, right, like it or don't like it. And then whatever that is, either party can complain of it. But in this case, because the trial court said two things. One, the record doesn't allow me to calculate. What does that mean? I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to litigate this. I consider this final. I'm not adjudicating this. There isn't enough evidence to do this. And second, that the court says there is a fixed number out there. That's it. If you don't like it, one of you challenge me. And neither did that particular point. Obviously, to challenge
But
everything.
did you did you appeal before the number was fixed?
Before the number was fixed. Before. Well, the number is fixed to the extent that the SDU has a number out there. And what that was wasn't obviously discussed. The trial judge simply said, whatever that number is, that's it.
Mr. Douglas, I think judge is asking whether or not you received the number from the SDU before you appealed on November 1st,
I seriously,
2023.
me personally, no, and I'm appellate counsel only. Me personally, no. No,
Right.
so I mean, I'm at where I'm at, and I know the next thing I'm about to say is that there is a record, but I am told the trial judge isn't following through on entering that fixed number from the SDU because this appeal is pending. I don't agree with that because of the general principle that underlying orders are enforceable but not modifiable when there's a notice of appeal pending. Again, the trial court had done something a little different yeah, there would be a problem. But there's nothing left to adjudicate. And the trial court said, I can't and won't figure out what that number is. So to me, there's very, again, I gave the example of go sell a house. It's a direction to go do that. So to me, there's little difference between that and saying, go plug in that number, whatever it is. It's not relief I would ask for. I'm
I
not
mean,
claiming it's the best way
it
to
kind
handle
of
it.
said, though, is you guys will never agree on a number, so you're stuck with this one. I'm not going to adjudicate it.
Well, if we are going to consider how contentious the case is, and I say that as my one time appearance appellate counsel and not the trial lawyer, was a dear friend. Yeah, I mean, it's highly contentious.
And I don't want to get to, I know you want to get to the merits of the other issue, and
I can answer your questions. I mean,
I
whatever.
think we've kind of talked this one out. If you'd like to move on, that's up to you, as if that's okay with Justice Heddle.
Is it?
Justice Holdridge.
Oh,
Yep.
Justice Holdridge, I apologize. If you know, maybe if you're told, but go ahead.
Okay. All right. Yeah. No, I don't have a whole lot more to say. I mean, my main issue is pinning it on the finality issue on the things I pointed to. The court saying I can't, in the record, based upon what's in the record, make that a determination. Go find that fixed number. I'm not doing this. But again, it's putting it very colloquially. So to me, that is what makes it that judgment a final judgment, rendering a 3-4A finding not necessary in any way. But regarding the what the court this I'm asking this court to look at and determining whether or not the underlying order should be found to be an abuse of discretion is to look at 505, significantly the financial resources and needs of the parents. Looking at the incomes are very stark. The opposing party is an attorney. Her income was one about 176 a year. Not even working full time, I don't believe. The dad's income had to be imputed up to 29 or so, which is just at minimum wage.
Yes.
He originally was a stay-at-home dad. He's making the income that he makes. And looking at the incomes of the two parties, it's very, very stark. Looking at the resources and needs of the parents when dad testified that he's paying for the clothes and so forth without any help, when his bank account was recently overdrawn three times, it is of record that his financial circumstances are very stark. Conversely, looking at Heather's situation, she has paid off real estate. $10,000 in the bank, $18,000 in stock, a 401k, $91,000, another one of 128,000 IRAs, approaching 80,000, et cetera, et cetera. August had something like $56 in the bank and $179 in the port and a 401k. Now, plugging that in to the legal standard of considering the financial resources and needs of the parents per 505, obviously. That is about as stark as it can get. Looking at that factor, to put it mildly, supports very little result other than granting the person making less than minimum wage retroactive support to provide for the children. I did reference the Sweet case and the FEDUN versus KUCZEK cases. Those are cases that looked at retroactivity, and they basically, again, just to put it plainly, seem to focus on, look, if you're going to ask for retroactive support and you dragged it out, you can't ask for this giant award if you're the reason for the delay. They seem to look at delay. Here, you don't have that. From the presentment of the motion of the hearing, what was less than 5 months, the judge ruled about 6 weeks later. There certainly wasn't anything along the lines of any kind of delay that should give this court pause to not award retroactive support, or put it a different way, this court is looking at whether the trial court abuses discretion, certainly looking at those financial circumstances. There's little to say other than the trial court should have. I think rough math, I noted in my brief, the asset ratio is something like 1,401.
Mr. Douglas, your time is up. The red light is on. Ah. You'll have time in reply.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hammond, you may respond.
Good morning, Justice Holdridge, and may it please the court and counsel. Beginning where this court began its questioning with Mr. Douglas is this court's own jurisdiction to hear the matter. As we set forth in our opening brief, Justice Holdridge, as you rightly pointed out, is your own determination whether the court has subject matter jurisdiction. It's not something we could confer by agreement. It's not necessarily an argument that I make. It is simply pointing out the state of the record to this court. And Justice Holdridge, as you pointed out, there are myriad things that are still remaining. Now, Mr. Douglas had indicated that the record did not allow the trial court to fully adjudicate their petition. Now, Mr. Douglas represented the move-ant who had both the burden of production and persuasion. So to the extent that he failed to produce or present information to allow the court to tie out all the quote-unquote loose ends and create a truly final judgment, that failure is Mr. Liffrith's alone.
Isn't the only loose end, counsel, the arrearage?
The arrearage, the calculation of withholding, and the effectuation of a support order moving forward.
It's all perfunctory work that's done after that number is determined, correct?
It may or may not be. As Justice Bertani pointed out, it is not necessarily that the trial court can just kick the determination of support to the SDU. The function of child support is a judicial function. It must ultimately be determined by a judge, and the ultimate conclusion must be reached by a judge, even in the case of agreement of the parties. A judge must still confirm that it is not contrary to the best interest of the minor children, even if the parties were to agree.
That's child support. We're talking about an arrearage. We're talking about an order that was paid before, or excuse me, an order that set an amount. How much did he pay? It's a math problem, right?
Yes, it is both a calculation of what was withheld and any other payments that were received. The record reflects that a tax return was intercepted at one point. And ultimately, the trial court directed the parties to submit the appropriate paperwork. I know that Mr. Douglas had indicated that he was told that the trial court refused to enter the appropriate paperwork, but I would invite the justices to look at the record as well as the underlying proceedings. No support order was ever proffered to the court. The final step was never taken. Ultimately, the step to determine finality was never taken by the appellant. And so for him to complain that it is not now done is something that I think is what is preventing this court from reaching its ultimate jurisdictional level. The recent persuasive case of marriage of Wheelock, which was a Second District case from your colleagues, that was a Rule 23, but went back to the underlying case of Petratus that dealt with a quadro. You could argue that the determination of a quadro is simply setting forth a number or setting forth an effectuation, but the court in Wheelock at paragraph 10 indicated it's not just what you do, it's how you do it. You're telling the parties how to effectuate, merely than just to effectuate. So I think for those same reasons, because you have a myriad of considerations here, the record also reflects that Ms. Burns is an hourly employee, so her income does fluctuate. All of these things to figure out how you're going to effectuate the order, how you're going to move forward with the order once it is finalized, still remains out there. So for those reasons, we do believe that this court lacks jurisdiction because there is not a final order. Well, Mr. Lifford also had a 510 pending at the time of the judgment. He had another 510 pending that was ultimately dismissed. Although that's not in the record, I do acknowledge that he ultimately voluntarily dismissed that before filing the appeal. So the question becomes simply whether the order that still requires directorate actions to the parties, that still has an unset number, that is not nearly just this is the number, it is SDU come up with the number, parties figure out what that means for the paperwork and give me the appropriate paperwork, which has just still never been done. And there's nothing in the record to suggest that that was because of the trial court or because of any other decision other than Mr. Lifford determining not to move forward with that. Turning to the merits, unless the court has any further questions on the jurisdictional issue, what we did not hear in the appellant's argument is also what we did not see in the appellant's brief, which is here is the law the judge violated, here is the fact that the judge got wrong, or anything other than I'm a reasonable person and I disagree with the judge, so I'd like a different outcome. That is not the standard of review before this court. Whether this court would have done it the same, differently, or otherwise, the question is, could any reasonable person have done what the circuit court did here? And I respectfully disagree with Mr. Douglas in that he said that the court did not consider financial resources of the parties. To the contrary, and going to the Dreisch case, I believe that where the court in Dreisch talked about financial resources, meaning more than just the income, more than just the assets in their name, the consideration of their overall household income. That case was in the context of 513, but the court also indicated that is relevant in the context of 505. The judgment indicates myriad findings, considering in great detail the party's income, in minute detail, figuring out to the hour calculations based on what they were earning, what was presented. It also contains pages of detail regarding Mr. Lifford's other financial resources, in this case, his spouse. At page C2283 in volume 3, there is an entire paragraph of all of the things that Mr. Lifford's spouse voluntarily contributed on his behalf without any expectation of repayment. As we set forth in our brief, there's a variety of ways that the court could have handled that. The court could have dealt with the recurring gift as an imputation of income. The court could have utilized the difference in his financial affidavit versus what he averred to spend versus what the actual evidence showed he spent and take the difference and calculate that. There were numerous things that could have resulted in a different number. Ultimately, this court is reviewing the trial court's overall ruling, and the trial court's overall ruling sets forth an equitable calculation that is considering all of the equitable factors, including the admitted need to impute income to Mr. Lifford. So when considering that over the life of the obligation, while Mr. Lifford does not take issue with any of the court's factual findings, any of the court's application of law, other than he would have reached a different outcome, there's nothing that he can point to that the judge objectively did wrong other than exercise his discretion in a way that he disagrees with. That is not an abuse of discretion. Reasonable minds can differ. That in and of itself, even if you were inclined to agree with Mr. Douglas, does not amount to an abuse of discretion. Based on diligent review, I have not been able to uncover a case in which the appellate court found that the circuit court abused its discretion in the application or denial of retroactivity, other than to go beyond the statute. Everybody here plainly agrees that the court had discretion to determine whether retroactivity was appropriate in this case. The court heard evidence, the court was presented with documentary and testamentary evidence, had the opportunity to review the parties' demeanors, consider the veracity of what each one of them said about their respective financial conditions, and weigh all of the considerations in reaching an overall figure that included setting of a start date. While the only portion of the support retroactivity, the only portion of the award that Mr. Lifford disagrees with is the retroactive portion, there is ample evidence in the record to suggest that Mr. Lifford did not, in fact, come out of pocket. Most tellingly, that his own financial affidavit and his testimony indicated that he did not actually incur these expenses, but he admitted that all of these were paid for him gratuitously with no expectation of repayment. That in and of itself could be enough. However, as we set forth in our brief, considering that his income could have been treated as higher, therefore increasing his portion of the income shares, And rather than doing that, the court did not utilize the wife's contribution in any way, shape, or form, but other than to consider it for the time that it actually and undisputedly occurred. That is the perfect exercise of discretion, in that Mr. Lifford has no further expectation or requirement that his wife continue to do what she did, that they continue to manage their household finances in the way that they had. But that was their choice. That was their voluntary choice. Mr. Lifford indicates that he has no home. He and his wife purchased a home during the marriage. They just titled it in her name. He claims he has no cars. They got two cars in record, including a new car recently, that they just titled in her name. That he chose not to title the property in his name does not diminish his financial resources. That they chose not to put both of them on the bank accounts does not diminish the fact that his financial resources admittedly included using the resources in his wife's name. His unfettered access, without any record evidence that there was any restriction thereon or any impediment thereto, is one reason of many, as we indicated, that the court could have, a reasonable person could have found, that additional retroactive payments were not appropriate in this particular instance. There were also ongoing back and forths, as indicated by Mr. Lifford's continued filings. There were disputes amongst the parties, as set forth in his subsequent 510. There were numerous back and forths, and the court considered all of it. The court considered exactly what he made, considered exactly his history of income, considered exactly what his spouse made, considered exactly the things that he said she paid for, considered exactly the things that Ms. Burns testified to, considered exactly her resources, her financial affidavit. Ultimately, the court came up with a number that was in between what the two parties suggested. It was more than Ms. Burns had suggested to pay and less than Mr. Lifford had wanted. Now that the court fashioned its equitable nature by the determination of a retroactive amount, which would have resulted in a significant lump sum for which Mr. Lifford did not actually expend any of his own resources, is an equitable determination that the court could make. And that is plainly what 510 says. One thing that I do agree with Mr. Douglas about is he talked about the timing aspect. And if the justices will look, Ms. Burns retained counsel, did not seek to continue the trial. And I agree with Mr. Douglas. The trial was had in a relatively timely fashion. I believe it was less than 6 months between the filing and when it was ultimately heard by evidentiary hearing. However, that lack of delay does not mean that it was an abuse of discretion not to make the award retroactive. If anything, the truncated timetable would suggest that the importance of retroactivity is lessened, not heightened. Moving forward, there is a number that is a number that is more than double what Mr. Lifford indicates are the child's needs. As we set forth in our brief, another way that the court could have determined support equitably is to use the child's needs because Mr. Lifford's income was difficult to determine, undisputed. He said it needed to be imputed. It had always been imputed. That is something that had always been an issue about Mr. Lifford's failure to accumulate assets or earn income commensurate with his ability. That had been something that had been an issue since the underlying divorce trial, and it's something that had repeatedly appeared before the court. And while the court did not hold his arrearage against him and indicates in the footnote to the judgment that that was not something that was held for or against either party, when you consider the overall application of 505 and the reasons that Mr. Lifford does purport to lack assets because he chose to put them in his wife's name, and because he has chosen for years and years and years not to work commensurate with his ability, as the record is replete with findings. All of these reasons are further reasons why a reasonable person could have determined that a five-month kicker, for using the common parlance, is not appropriate in this case in light of these facts. Perhaps Mr. Douglas disagrees with the ultimate determination, but he does not suggest that there is an area of law that was not applied. And contrary to his suggestion, the court did expressly state that it was considering Section 505 as incorporated by 510, and that's set forth on page 2 of the judgment, C2278. So the court used the right legal framework. The court considered all of the facts as they were presented, and the court heard evidence and applied the existing law in its discretion, as nobody disputes it had the discretion to do. Ultimately, the appellant does not like the outcome, but I wish it went the other way, is not an abuse of discretion. Unless the justices have any questions, I will yield the remainder of my time.
Any questions from the bench?
None here.
Mr. Hammond, you were on such a nice roll there. Are you still suggesting that we shouldn't accept this case on jurisdiction?
Well, I certainly think that if the court were inclined to accept it, a swift affirmance would be appropriate. It does not change the fact that I have the question on whether or not this is a final order. Ultimately, that is a determination for your justices and not for me. But I do want to present it to the court because in light of Petratus and Wheelock, I do have a legitimate question as to whether there was even a final order in the first place.
Thank you, Mr. Hammond.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Douglas, you may reply.
Thank you. Just to touch upon some of the matters the counsel covered. Counsel, when I reference that the record does not permit the trial court to adjudicate the arrearage, and counsel's response to me was, or to my client, it's my burden to make the record and so forth. I wasn't saying the record doesn't permit me to do anything. I was referring to the statement of the trial court itself. The trial court saying the record doesn't permit me, the trial judge, and that's at page 2285, volume 3. Open quote, the record does not allow the court to calculate the current amount of that arrearage, close quote. So it isn't an issue of me not making the record. I'm referring to the record and the statement of the trial judge there. So just wanted to make that clarification. With respect to Wheelock, I was one of the attorneys on Wheelock, so I'm familiar with it. But in Wheelock, the issue as to whether or not you had a final order below, there in Wheelock, the court permitted a recalculation of the benefits per a quildro. There were prior orders, and upon the motion of the payee, Grant said, yes, we'll have an amended quildro, and there will be a recalculation. Now that, just by what I just said, that's obviously distinguishable from what we have here. Why? Here, again, whether, you know, to Justice Heddle's point, whether it was a good or bad idea, there's a difference between go get your word processor and plug in that fixed number from the SDU and, you know, figure out what we should put into a quildro, which is daunting to even most divorce practitioners. Frankly, there's a handful of people out there that do that kind of work. I'm not among them, thankfully. But there's a difference between that would be more like a direction to amend the support order. That would make this analogous to Wheelock, or perhaps even, as I discussed earlier, go calculate what the arrearage is. Wheelock said, we're going to enter some order in the future and move the numbers around. Here, there was no such direction, no such finding, no such judgment. So looking at that line of cases in Wheelock, those are amply distinguishable from the current situation. Regarding my purportedly arguing the court didn't consider the financials below. I'm not saying they didn't receive the information. They did. I'm arguing that due to the existence of that, and it's off record, and that's how I'm able to cite it in the brief, that given those financials, given the somebody who had to have income imputed up to part-time as against an attorney, given the asset ratio of 1,400 to 1, given that data, which was considered, the trial court abused its discretion. There was a reference to the Dreisch case, Dreisch, I believe. And it is a 513 case, and that is relevant because there, in determining whether or not you're going to look at anything having to do with a spouse, that references the language of 513 and the word resources, where section 505 references income. There's a reason that 505 and 513 are interpreted differently, and you can look at different things pursuant to those different statutes because of the language in each statute. And the language, resources versus income, is distinguishable, and that makes Dreisch not directly applicable to 505. And the law has long since been, if you remarry your new husband, your new wife, he or she doesn't have to pay child support for your kids. And there's a good reason for that, and that is the law in this state. Regarding, and it was touched upon a little bit, what wife's income being a gift, she pays the expenses and so forth. The trial court looked at that. The trial court looked at all of that, and the trial court made its decision and didn't move the numbers around based upon any of that. The opposing party could have, but did not appeal the trial court's determination not to move the number down based upon that income of August's wife. And as I noted in my brief on page 8, the appellee fails to file the cross appeal. Reviewing court is confined to only those issues raised by the appellant. So I just do not believe that that is properly before the court. It's being held out as, well, look, there's evidence in the record, affirm. And of course, you can affirm based upon evidence in the record, whether or not it would, the trial judge articulated that as a basis. I get that, and I know that. But truthfully, that argument is about the wife's income when there was no cross appeal is raising of an issue that they should have, but did not raise in a cross appeal. So I just do not agree that that is something to be considered to the extent that counsel is a little, I'm done. All right. Okay, thank you very much. My camera is one way and the red light is another, so I apologize for that.
Any further questions for Mr. Douglas from the court?
No, no, thank you.
Okay.
Well, thank you, counsel, both for your arguments in this matter this morning. It will be taken under advisement and a written disposition shall issue.